Today's Teisho is on case 41 in the Haikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Joshu and the Great Death. Engo's Introduction. When right and wrong are intermingled, even the holy ones cannot distinguish between them. When positive and negative are interwoven, even the Buddha fails to discern one from the other. The most distinguished man of transcendent experience cannot avoid showing his ability as a great master. He walks the ridge of an iceberg, he treads the edge of a sword, he is like the Kirin's horn, like the lotus flower in the fire. Meeting a man of transcendent experience, he identifies with him as his equal. Who is he? See the following. Main subject. Joshu asked Tosu, "What if a man of the great death comes back to life again?" Tosu said, "You should not go by night. Wait for the light of day and come." Secho's verse, "Open-eyed, he was all the more as if dead. What use to test the master with something taboo? Even the Buddha said he had not reached there. Who knows when to throw ashes in another's eyes?" This is the final day of our winter 2004 sesshin, and I think it's been a wonderful sesshin. People have practiced with great diligence, extraordinary diligence. I have been amazed by the sitting I've seen, and since Zen is my thing, that is, makes my week, makes my year. When, I love this beautiful path, and when I see people who are walking this beautiful path wholeheartedly with great courage, and courage is really the right word, I think, it's quite inspiring to me. And much has been accomplished at this sesshin. A real practice, there have been a number of kensho experiences at the sesshin. And these are quite hard to achieve, as you know, because everybody's been working so hard. But, when people have a kensho experience or a breakthrough, it's really something to feel good about. By kensho, I mean an opening up into reality. When people talk about Zen practice, they often talk about Zen as nothing happens for this many years. Year one, nothing happens. Year two, nothing happens. Year three, nothing happens. Year four, nothing happens. Year five, year six, year seven, bing, Daikensho, enlightened. After that, you float on clouds and so on and so on. This is the mythology. This is actually a misrepresentation of the way Zen practice works. In fact, people practice and they have insight, and then they have another insight, a kensho, an opening, and another kensho, and another kensho, and another kensho, and then they have dai kensho. But still, there are openings. So it's important to understand that every opening is really a glimpse of enlightened being. It's a wonderful road when this happens, and it's a wonderful road when it doesn't happen. More on that in just a minute. But, enlightenment, so-called, the experience of the world from the standpoint of the host is a big beast. When people asked the Buddha about enlightenment, he said, it can be described in different ways, just as a blind man feeling an elephant would describe an elephant in different ways. I'm sure you know the story. This story has circulated around the world and it's told in a million different ways, but actually it's from India and it actually comes out of Buddhism. And a Buddha said basically that this enlightenment, this experience of fundamental reality is so vast that human beings with their small minds, being the humans that we are, we have to experience it in pieces because it's so huge compared to our limited understanding. So, one person feels the trunk, one person feels the belly, one person feels the leg, all. Well, this is what Zen practice is all about. It's like koan by koan, assignment by assignment, we move towards the whole elephant. But every time we move towards a glimpse of the whole elephant, maybe I should say. But the truth is, every time we encounter the elephant, we really encounter the elephant. So, a kensho is a kensho, and a wonderful thing. Always an encounter with reality, with reality. So, people have had different kinds of kensho. One person says it's like electricity flowing through my body. Somebody else says I feel that I'm facing a tornado. It moves like a tornado. See, this is these are experiences of fundamental reality. These take extraordinary concentration and diligence on the cushion. Somebody else talked about hara becoming activated. Extraordinary. If you told somebody about these experiences, they wouldn't even understand them because they just don't dwell in the realm of that we are dwelling in. And these are glimpses of the elephant. And each time they happen, we are encountering more and more of the elephant. We're changing our capacity to experience reality by experiencing reality. More and more and more and more, we become more and more and more open. This is really, difficult to do. Because, attending a sesshin really takes, I mentioned earlier, takes courage. You have to be willing to fail to come to sesshin. It takes great courage to come here and say, all right, I'm going to believe in something and the possibility of something called enlightenment. And I don't know if it's real or not, and I don't know if I'll ever encounter it. Seems so unlikely, right? Seems so unlikely that I could ever encounter it, being who I am. And of course, you shouldn't, but if you were to look around the Zendo, you wouldn't see a single person who didn't have that thought. And in fact, if you could stand in Tushita heaven and see all the assembly of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you would not see a single being who didn't start his or her practice in Zen or in Buddhism with the same fear, the same anxiety about the unattainability of Dai Kensho, of great awakening. So it takes extraordinary courage to come here and do this. And it's not the physical challenge. Okay, there is a physical challenge, that's obvious. I mean, that's obvious. But that's not what makes people, we have 14 people here, 20 people said they were coming. A couple people had genuinely had problems that prevented them from coming. But, you know, something like 4 people just made themselves scarce as Sesshin approached. And these are not people who have gone to Sesshin before. So they were very eager to let me know they wanted to come, and then at the last minute they disappeared. Now see, they don't know anything yet about about the physical aspects of this. You know, they don't know. So why didn't they come? See, it's lack of courage and lack of trust, right? You know, this takes a kind of a trust in life. And every step of Zen practice is really about learning how to taking a risk and learning how to trust. You know, so people come to Sesshin, and in spite of all their doubts and all their fears that is such a thing as enlightenment, and B, that it's attainable in this life by this person, you know, they come anyway and they take a chance. They take a risk, you know. And this is what I call making yourself available. You know, yesterday I said, when you call moo, you have to risk absurdity. You know, you risk, you know, you go in the room and go moo, or whatever, you know. You're risking being an idiot, right? Or feeling like an idiot. But you know, that takes great courage and it takes great trust in life, right? Because you go in and what you're really saying is, okay, you say divine possession, right? You're saying divine possession. You know, fat, what are the chances? Fat chance, right? You know, come on. Well, if you really were cynical in that way, you wouldn't be here. So you had the courage to come here. But when you say that, divine possession, you know, what are the odds, right, you think? But actually, at this Sesshin, I have seen divine possession, right? People making breakthroughs, people having Kensho experiences. And it requires is that you make yourself available. Every day we sit on the cushion and we make ourselves available. And that takes great courage and great trust. You're vulnerable, right? The more you invest of your time and energy in Zen practice, the more vulnerable you become, right? Because you've put all this time and energy into something. And it's a very moving expression of trust in life. And it's like the more you put into it, the more vulnerable you become, right? Because, you know, you're putting so many years of your life into this, you're investing, so to speak, your time in this. You're hoping there will be a quote-unquote payoff. And that actually is a very noble behavior. Great courage in doing it. You're gambling on the goodness of the universe. You're gambling on the universe's concern for you as a person. And you're gambling on your own ability to have contact with the universe. So that's a tall order. And that's what it takes to get a person to come to Sesshin and practice. And when people, you know, come to Sesshin, we have to learn how to, you know, dying on the cushion is one way to put it. Another way to put it is that we are learning how to trust even more radically, right? Because when you sit on the cushion and you empty yourself out, you really are putting yourself in the hands of you know not what, right? I mean, this is such an important aspect of Zen practice. You're putting yourself in the hands of you know not what, and you're waiting with a blank mind for the universe to inhabit your body and tell you what to do. And each moment of this practice is an exercise in this kind of openness, this kind of trust. And the interesting thing is, the more you do it, I believe, the happier you become. You know, if you just do this if you do one sesshin and you never do another one, I think you've had a wonderful experience. You know, I think it's probably changed your life, because you've tasted this openness, this openness, the possibility that, you know, the possibility that there's a real connection between human beings and the universe, you know. And that's what Zen is all about. That's what this practice is really all about. We're gambling on that connection, right? And this is, Zen is not a vehicle that talks about faith very much, but it takes great faith in the goodness of this world to practice Zen. And I think what happens to people if they practice properly is that they develop a deeper confidence, deeper trust in the world, in the universe. And it happens in a strange way. You know, in the tradition that we're practicing in, there's two schools of Zen. And the one school is called the Rinzai, and one school is called the Soto. Or one is Linji, and the other is Tsao-tung. So the Japanese say Rinzai, you know, and Tsao-tung becomes Soto. So the Rinzai tradition is the tradition that is well known for putting a great deal of emphasis on the pursuit of enlightenment itself, Kensho. And so Rinzai is famous for having very demanding standards of practice. Koan training is really Rinzai Zen originally. The other school is known as the Soto school. And Soto has a very different approach. You know, if you go to a traditional Soto sesshin, there may be no discussion of enlightenment or Kensho at all. Very little emphasis on this. It's all the emphasis is just on being in the moment. Just being in the moment. If you read there's a classic Zen book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is by a Roshi named Suzuki Roshi. And if you read that book, it sells many thousands of copies every year. Apparently the press that puts it out is kept afloat by that one book. Weatherhill is kept afloat by that one book. It sustains their whole press year after year. It's a masterpiece in the Soto tradition. It never even talks about Kensho. All it talks about is being in the moment. Now, you know, both of these traditions have very different emphases, and both have their strengths and their weaknesses. You know, the good part about the Soto tradition is that it makes people appreciate being in the moment, in a way that sometimes a Rinzai tradition, with its emphasis on Kensho, 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 doesn't manage to do. On the other hand, you know, the Buddha did not teach just being in the moment. He taught pursuing enlightenment. And he talked about enlightenment quite often. So, both of these are legitimate practices, and actually both of them lead in a similar direction. You know, in the Rinzai tradition, we put a great deal of emphasis on this pursuit of Kensho. So, you know, people are exhorted to practice with diligence in order to have Kensho experiences. Breakthrough, breakthrough, breakthrough. But you know, if you want to have a Kensho experience, you will never have one. This is very interesting. You know, when you try to have Kensho, you won't succeed. This is, I think, quite a profound lesson about how to live in trust, see? You have to make the effort. You have to come to sesshin. You have to sit on your cushion and not move when you want to move. You have to die on the cushion and so on and so on. But that doesn't mean anything is going to happen, see? Basically, you have to reach a state where you just don't care. You reach a state where you just don't care. You know, it's easy to idealize the experience of great Zen teachers, but for all of them, it was the same thing. You know, they all started out with high aspirations to have Kensho, and then they had a series of failures, right? So, you know, for most people in their minds, when they think about Zen practice, they think they're going to go to sesshin and they're going to have an enlightenment experience. This is what I thought. I thought I was going to go to sesshin, I was going to get enlightened, and who knows, you know, maybe I wouldn't have to work anymore. Or, you know, really. I had no idea. I was, you know, not very bright, you know. So I thought, you know, all my problems will be gone. I'll have Kensho. Maybe I'll have magic powers. You know, Roshi was going to take me into Dokusan and go, okay, now twirl around 3 times, you know, and clap your hands, and you'll enter the fourth dimension or something like that, you know. Instead, he just said, watch your breath, right? And I had a lot of pain and so on and so on. So, not what I anticipated, I have talked about this a lot, you know, when Genki Roshi came from Japan, there were, you know, this was the, these were the late 60s, early 70s, so lots of hippies were into Zen, and when they heard this Zen master had come from Japan, man, they came out of the woodwork, you know, you had 40 people for the first sesshin. So we all got the breath koan. We were all given the breath koan, watch the breath perception. And basically what happened was that, you know, within a year or two, about 15 people just disappeared because they didn't have the trust. They didn't have the trust. But there were a core of about 25 people who persisted. But I couldn't help but notice that they were going into Dokusan, and you know, they'd go into Dokusan, and Dokusan they'd be in Dokusan for a long time, and when they'd come out, you know, I could see like a little smile on their face, you know, and I thought that, you know, they answered their koan, you know. And I was stuck with my koan, you know. I was doing breath perception for 5 years or six, it seemed like forever. Everybody else, you know, you're never supposed to discuss what happens in Dokusan, and I hope you never do. It's, you know, between you and me and your true self. But basically, you know, on the way home, we would be, I would hear people saying, oh yeah, I passed the mu koan, you know. And, really, you know? Now, I passed this koan. I'm working on one-hand clapping. Oh, yeah? Oh, what did you say? You know? And really? I was working on the breath koan, and I heard this woman, Gina, who was in the dance troupe, the Bill Evans dance troupe. And she and Bill Kugler, her boyfriend, who was my good friend, said to Gina, well, what did you, you know, you passed the breath koan. Great. What did you say to the teacher? You know, what did you say to Genki? She said, oh, I said, peach. So I went in and said, peach, you know. What an idiot, right? You know? It worked for her. So, you know, we do things a little differently here, but in a traditional Dokusan encounter, the Roshi signals that you're done by ringing a little bell. And he sometimes will do it right in the middle of a statement. You'll come in and say, well, I think I'm getting closer. And if the Roshi, you know, the classical Dokusan style is not for the Roshi to sit there and go, oh, yeah, well, try, you know, that's good, you know, keep trying. They'll just say, get out, you know, that's full, you're full of crap, get out. That's, you know, you're not doing your koan, you're doodling around in your head out, you know. So, you know, these people would go in to Dokusan and they'd be in there. And then my turn would come up. And I mean, I would get in the room, I'd be there for a second, and it would be like, and you know, everybody could see, it was like the quickest Dokusans on record, you know. So, you know, if you could have like a little camera in the Dokusan room and it would show my career in Zen for 5 years, it would be like this. It's a failure, right? And you know, basically, when I was in high school, I was like a real nerd, you know. Probably that doesn't come as a surprise. So, you know, basically, I was, you know, a very good student. I always tried to get good grades, and, you know, I wanted to get a good report card. And so, you know, I was getting bad report cards in Zen, right? And this was very distressing to me. It caused me a lot of problems, you know, and very mixed emotions about Zen practice, because I wanted to be successful, I wanted to be a winner, etc., etc., and I was going in and I was getting Fs on my report card, basically. Now, you know, part of this was my own personality, my own karma, right? Other people did pass their koans much more quickly than I did because they weren't so hung up on certain things. Another way to put it is they had greater trust. They were capable of greater trust than I was. They could simply have greater confidence or just let go, greater faith in things. I hung on so tightly, I was so afraid to trust, that I couldn't get anywhere with my koan. I kept going in to see Genki Roshi and I kept wanting to say something totally profound, you know. He would go, "Oh, you're the reincarnated so-and-so, you know, that's fantastic, you know." I wanted him to say something that would acknowledge me as special. And so I would go into the Dokusan room and I tried everything. I had poetry, you know, I would write poetry. I came in and I had this ridiculous poem, you know. And one time, you know, I tried to be creative. I would bring like, you know, things. I would find an object, like a flower, and bring it in. I held up a flower, you know, there's a koan where the Buddha holds up a flower. So I pulled a flower out of the robe and showed it to him. It's like, you know, I don't know how he kept from not laughing. You know? He probably did after I was gone. You know? There was only one time, actually, in our Zen Center, Webb used to translate for Roshi, and there was one time a good friend of mine named Jeff Jongaward went into Dokusan. And he went in and all of a sudden you could hear Genki and Webb roaring with laughter. I don't know what happened, but they have a very good relationship. I think what happened was that Jeff forgot his koan, you know. He went in and said, "I can't remember my koan," you know. So anyway, those things happen, and actually that's not such a bad thing. So I just didn't have the trust, you know, and so I was stuck in Zen kindergarten for 5 years. But you know, this was partly my personality, but partly this is a part of the Zen or the Rinzai strategy, you know, which says the goal, go for the goal. But at the same time, if you want the goal, you can't get the goal. See, you can't make something happen when you're on the cushion. You have to want it to happen. You have to try, but then you have to give up. It's like a big contradiction. But this is how we relate to. This is how we have to relate to the universe, right? I mean, You have to want it, you have to commit, you have to sit deeply. And that's an expression of your trust. But then there's an even higher trust, which is let it be. You know, what will happen is, whatever will happen is Buddha nature. See? Even not answering your koan is a manifestation of Buddha nature. So these two things are always in tension in the Zen hall, but it's very important to cultivate both forms of trust. The kind of trust that allows you to practice with a whole heart. And I have to say, I saw that, you know, this Zendo was fantastic. You know, really and truly, this was an incredibly productive sesshin. Genki Roshi told me that when he was studying with Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, you know, these were all professional monks. They were all sitting on their cushion. You know, they'd get up in the morning and think, okay, I've got 14 hours to bedtime. And, you know, they'd be sitting on the cushion in the morning thinking, what's for breakfast? And they'd be sitting on the cushion at lunch, in the afternoon thinking, what's for dinner? You know, and they all had guaranteed incomes and so on. And at the end of, these were 7-day sesshins. At the end, Genki said, the teacher, Yamamoto Roshi Genpo, said, at the end of one of his sesshins, he said, nobody has accomplished anything at this sesshin. That's it. Nobody goes home. We're doing another one. And Genki always said, boy, there were kenshos next time. You know? People died on the cushion at that time, you know. So everybody, fortunately, people practiced, really practiced here in a way that would, you know, wherever you go, you will never see better practice than you've seen in this Zendo. So you have done a wonderful job, you know. So, you know, this art of Zen, though, is really the art of living, right? You have to do your best and then you have to let go. Do your best and then let go, and don't evaluate your performance. You know, everybody has, sooner or later, kensho experiences. You know, and after you've had, mine came very, very late, you know. After 5 or 6 years, I finally had a breakthrough with the mu koan. And I never really passed breath meditation. Genki just moved me on. He said, well, you know, let's try something else, you know, maybe this will work. That was the style, you know. So basically he moved me to the mu koan, and finally I had a breakthrough. And then after that I felt like I was walking on air, and then the next koan I was just back in the same old place, not knowing where I, what I was doing, what I, you know. So it didn't really solve my problem, as it turned out. I had to learn to trust all over again, you know. And when you try to duplicate your breakthrough, you just mess it up, you know. If you have a certain kind of experience and then you imagine it happening again at your next sesshin, you can't make any progress because you're not open to the new moment, you know. So even when you're successful, you have to give up your success. You have to let your success go. Don't even think about it. This is why in this Zen tradition, when, you know, when we would go in to see Genki, for example, he was a very typical Japanese teacher. He wouldn't, even if you had a breakthrough, he wouldn't go, well now, well, very good. You know, you've really done a wonderful job. That is fantastic, you know, blah, blah, blah. He'd just go, oh, well, you know, I guess I'll pass you. You know, well, here's another one. You know, very like, you know, try not to screw this up, you know. And it was very deflating in a way, but it was doing, and he was not a mean person. I hope I'm not making him sound that way. He was a wonderful, extraordinarily kind person. But he wanted people not to be attached to their kenshos either. He said, don't be attached even to this. You know, this is just on to the next day, on to the next failure, right? On to the next failure. And so you have, I passed the mukho on next year, and so on and so on, you know. Living with that kind of failure is the best thing in the world, because it deepens our capacity to trust. See, I mean, if you do something and you get rewarded for it right away, that doesn't deepen your capacity to trust. It makes you, believe it or not, makes you less trusting. And life becomes like a contract. The least trusting form of life is the contract, right? No offense. I mean, we all need contracts, but when you try to make a contract with the universe, you really shortchange yourself. This is when you come to Zen practice, you're writing the universe, you're giving the universe a blank check, really. See, that's what it takes. So you're sitting on the cushion and you're saying, I don't know how long this is going to take, I don't know what is going to happen, but I give myself to the universe. I give myself up to this world, and I trust that what happens will be okay. See? And there's no timetable. I don't reckon the time. There's no clock running on this. And I give up, and I make the effort, and then whatever happens is a manifestation of Buddha nature itself. So, you know, if you start out with the Rinzai attitude, you wind up with the Soto attitude. Just be in the moment with a whole heart, see. And the truth is, you know, people who practice and start with the Soto attitude, if they persist long enough, begin to develop a Rinzai attitude. Because they begin to notice that they can't be in the moment with a whole heart very easily. And when they begin to notice that, they begin to have certain kinds of conflicts, you know. So both of these methods lead to the same sort of tension. You have to make the effort, and then you have to give up. And you have to avoid evaluating your performance. As for the issue of a timetable, everybody in this room, every morning and every afternoon, we take a vow, and the vow is the four great vows. Sentient beings are everywhere. I vow to open myself up to all of them. Or another way to say it is, I vow to encounter all of them. Physical illusion is so real, I vow to see it for what it is. Aspects of being are infinite. I vow to know them all. This is a maybe not the best translation. Webb is usually a good translator, but basically what this person is saying is that sentient beings are everywhere. I vow to help all of them. The world is vast. I vow to understand it all. Buddha nature is infinite. I vow to unify my heart with Buddha nature. Okay, now this means infinite process, right? Not one sesshin, not 10 sesshin, not one lifetime, you know, many lifetimes. I give myself, my vow, my commitment is to wake up and help other beings forever, forever and ever, and ever and ever. This is like trust, right? Even if it takes me 20 lifetimes, I'm going to wake up. Even if it takes me endless rebirth in worlds of suffering, I am going to help other people wake up once I have wakened up. See, this is the vow. That's the four great vows. So it's a blank check handed to the universe. That's the spirit in which things happen in Zen. If you have a condition, if you have a contract, the universe will not deliver. And it doesn't deliver because you're not letting it deliver. You know, I used to sit. After a while, I got to be a really good sitter. And I could sit longer than anybody else in the Zendo, and this was a source of great pride to me, that in a very bad way. I was very competitive about my practice. And I didn't sit for a long time because I love it, which is the case now. I did it because I wasn't passing my koans, I guess, and I wanted to compensate. So I could sit forever, and I still couldn't answer my koan. And I went in to see the Roshi, and finally, you know, for once he didn't throw me out, he let me talk and complain. And I said, I don't get it, you know, I can sit from now until the cows come home and I can't answer my koan. And he said, you can't break the door down, you have to knock, you know. And that was very profound, I thought. You know, you can't make it happen. All you can do is make yourself available with an open heart. If your heart is open, something will happen. And if your heart is not open, you know, it's because you're still in a contractual relationship. So this practice is really about wholehearted trust. You know, we say in the West, thy will be done. See, the East is everything is Buddha nature. Everything is Buddha nature. So, Joshu asked Tosu, what if a man of the great death comes back to life again? Tosu said, you should not go by night, wait for the light of day and come. When we give up, when we try and when we give up, the universe can inhabit our bodies. This is after the great death, what happens? After you die on the cushion, what happens? This beautiful life, this beautiful world. And if you feel happy, it's because the universe is living through your body, living through your life. So, you know, people have talked about the joy they have felt at this sesshin. That's the joy of the universe in you. See, there's a little catch here in the first part of the koan. He says, the most distinguished man of transcendent experience cannot avoid showing his ability as a great master. In other words, Engo says, there's a certain person who is a superlative master, deeply unified with Buddha. He walks the ridge of an iceberg. He treads the edge of a sword. He's like the Kirin's horn, like the lotus in the fire. See, we think, oh my God, who is this person? He must be must be the Dalai Lama. Must be somebody really special. Joshu says, who is he? See, who is he? Who is this special person? You know, who is the host? You are the host. See? And when you trust, your host comes out. So, we have one last dokusan today, and anything can happen. You know, the sitting this morning was absolutely superb, and you know, we have sits this afternoon, and then we have dokusan, and that will be the end of the day. So please continue to make an effort, serious effort, and also please continue to let go. And as I say, you know, anything can happen. People have people have resolved their koans in the last hours of a sesshin. So thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to that last dokusan.